Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here on Tuesday, October 10th, 2017, to talk about Week 5 of the NFL season, some news and stories coming out of Week 5 of the season this week, and joining me to do that and discuss a trade that just recently happened before we recorded the podcast today is ESPN's Dan Graziano. Dan, how are you?
I'm great, Bill. How are you doing on this? I guess are we still considering ourselves in Week 5 before we put a bow on it and then we move on to Week 6?
I would say physically we're in Week 6. Emotionally, I'm still in Week 5.
All right, that's fair. That's
mentally,
totally
I'm
fair.
Still in Week 5. I'm still thinking about what happened as opposed to what's going to happen next.
All right.
I have a lot more faith in my ability to break down what's happened as opposed to what is about to happen.
Well, there's no doubt about that. That makes two of us.
Yes, and what has happened, something that did happen today, in fact, the Adrian Peterson trade. Adrian Peterson was dealt away from the New Orleans Saints to the Arizona Cardinals. Your initial thoughts upon hearing about the trade?
I think the Cardinals are desperate. I'm not stealing from you there. That was one of my initial thoughts before I even saw the headline on the column you just posted a little while ago. But I think that's, you know, this is a team. I think when we've talked about the Cardinals this season, we said this is a tightrope team, right? It could go either way. They could be a legitimate title contender or a complete washout. And I think they've sort of kept it together early on in spite of, you know, one of the more devastating injuries of the year is the David Johnson injury, given what a part of their offense he was. So now you have, well, Chris Johnson's not getting it done. Adrian Peterson's available for low cost. The Saints are done with him. Turns out they didn't need him. So can we get him and give it a shot? Maybe it revives him. Maybe, you know, because they have issues up front blocking in the run game. And Adrian Peterson, when he was great, was a Bill Polian says, a bring your own blocking kind of back, right? Like he didn't, you know, he could succeed in spite of poor blocking. So maybe there's a little bit of that left and you can jump on it and it helps you. I think it's a long shot, but I don't think it costs them much.
That's the thing, right? Is that, you know, even if it doesn't work out, they're giving up what Adam Schefter just would call a conditional sixth round pick.
Right.
So it seems like it's not going to make that much of a difference. And this is a team that really is all in for the not only last year, but also this year, given that their veterans are guys who are on their way out of the league. Larry Fitzgerald might be retiring after this year. Carson Palmer might be retiring after this year. Who knows what Bruce Arians' future is going to be like in Arizona. I mean, there's major question marks about what this team is going to look like in 2018 and 2019. So for, you know, with the Vikings, for example, last year, I wasn't a big fan of the Sam Bradford trade. It worked out a lot better than I could have thought. But at the time, I said, okay, well, you know, if you have a lost year, it stinks, but you still got a lot of talent. You're still going to come back in 2017 and 2018, 2019 and still be a good football team. With the Cardinals, they can't really afford to have a lost season. If this season's a lost season, you know, it could be the last time they're competitive or at least thinking about being competitive for several years going forward.
Yeah, I remember last training camp, so training camp 2016, I was talking to Steve Keim, their GM, and I said, how much do you think about like what comes after Carson Palmer here? And he said, it's all I think about. And yet they haven't done it. They haven't figured out who's coming after Carson Palmer. So they're right on a cliff. Whether they win or lose this year, they may end up, as you say, starting from scratch in 2018. So certainly, if you have to do that, you'd rather go all in and cap it off with something special if you can. So who knows? I mean, if Adrian Peterson saves the Cardinals' season and they make a playoff or Super Bowl run as a result of it, that's going to be like one of the top five stories, on-field stories, of the entire NFL season.
Yeah, and I mean, the cost really isn't that much. So even though he's not going to solve their problems in the secondary, even though he's not a quarterback, even though he's not an offensive lineman, given that they have myriad problems, given they have issues on different parts of their roster, this is one way they could address one of the problems on their roster without mortgaging their future. So I think it's worth a shot at the very least. I don't know that it's going to work. I'm skeptical of Adrian Peterson as well, but it does seem like given how bad their running backs have been over the last few weeks, especially that combo of Kerwin Williams and Chris Johnson, it does seem like even if it's a mediocre version of Adrian Peterson versus the guy we saw a few years ago, that could still possibly be an upgrade on the guys they had heading into week six.
Yeah, and two ancillary parts of this. I mean, what it says about Alvin Kamara and what the Saints think of him, he's a bigger part of their plans for this year than they expected him to be when they drafted him. They really like what they've seen. And number two, you talk about things that matter to players more than they do fans or us. Adrian Peterson's going to get two bye weeks this year. He got it off from the Saints, right? And then when the Cardinals have their bye week, he'll be off then too. So that's nice little comfy scheduling for a veteran like himself. So
it's way better than playing 17 games. That's for sure.
Exactly right.
So that was the biggest news of Tuesday. But on Sunday, we had two major injuries pop up. Arguably, the two most notable non-quarterbacks in football went down for the season. Certainly, two of the more known players on both sides of the football. So we'll start with J.J. Watt, who suffered a tibial plateau fracture. Is going to miss the rest of the season. And it's sort of a complicated injury in that you can have, obviously, different levels of these fractures. Des Bryant had one a few weeks ago, as Al Michaels pretended to come up with off the top of his head on the podcast, or on the broadcast Sunday night. That was a few-week injury. This is going to be a season-ending injury, and it's going to be a major concern for the Texans, because they're not just losing J.J. Watt this year. They're also losing Whitney Mercilus, who took up a lot of the slack for him, who's out for the year with a torn pectoral as well. So do you think this is a thing where the defense can still survive without them, or is it going to have to be a situation where the offense is going to have to pick up the slack in Houston?
I think, unfortunately for them, it's going to be a situation where the offense has to pick up the slack. And I say unfortunately not because I don't like Deshaun Watson. I do, but because he's a rookie who's likely to have some twists and turns. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is how he's going to play forever and ever. So this is a team built to win up front on defense. And to lose Watt and Whitney Mercilus, I mean, you talk about, I don't know how you rank them and Jadeveon Clowney, but it's possible they lost their two best front seven players in one game. And certainly two of the three. So they're definitely going to hurt for this. I don't know how they necessarily overcome it. Now, can they coach it up? Can Clowney do more? Do they have good people in reserve behind those guys? Yes, but over the course of what remains here, 11 games for them, those absences are going to show up. Because you might be able to win a game or two on, you know, that whole next man up thing and adrenaline and all that, but over the course of 11 games, and that's still a substantial percentage of the season, this is a team designed to win with these guys up front, and two of their most major pieces are gone. I just think over the course of, the longer the sample size stretches out, the more that shows up.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you think about last year, not only did they have Whitney Mercilus, they had John Simon, who was a useful part, who's now in Indianapolis. They had A.J. Bouye, who really stepped up for their cornerback with Kevin Johnson hurt, and he's now in Jacksonville. So they had better coverage last year in a lot of ways than they've had so far this season. So major concerns there. But, yeah, the offense, it should be better. But
it
now,
should be. And they got Will Fuller back in the mix, and that matters. And Hopkins is obviously still a special player. Mm-hmm. But they still have issues on the line there. And again, it's just, you know, when I was at their camp, it was, well, Watt wasn't really practicing, and, you know, they expect him to be back, and that would be a difference maker. But even if he isn't his old self, my goodness, Mercilus is coming on. You wouldn't believe how great he looks in practice. So, you know, that was kind of the hedge on, well, if Watt doesn't make it all the way back, and now they've lost that too.
Yeah, it really reduces their margin for error. Also, Brian Cushing, someone who we don't even really think about as much, is suspended for the first 10 games of this, or this era, week 2 to week 11, I think.
So, I mean, like, when you start looking at, getting decimated at one position group in basically one game, or certainly the early part of the season, that's a pretty hard thing to overcome, no matter who you are. And I have a hunch, Bill, that your next topic focuses on a team that had something like that happen to them as well.
I'm trying to think of another team that had that happen to a much less important position.
Scroll through the standings and see.
Yeah, let's get to the bottom. It's going to take a while to get there. But in fact, the New York Giants, their wide receiving core, which seemed so promising before the season, doesn't really seem to exist anymore. They lost Sterling Shepard to an ankle injury. They lost Brandon Marshall to a season-ending ankle injury. And then at the end of the game, of course, Odell Beckham suffered a fractured fibula. And is done for, most likely at the very least, done for 2017. A lot of ways to go with this one. Obviously, the Giants were probably not going to be competitive the rest of the year, or not be a playoff team the rest of the year, given that they ended up starting 0-5. Even if Beckham had stayed healthy, if they had lost that game to the Chargers, their playoff odds were going to be basically nil. So they're not going to be a competitive team. It hurts in terms of the short term, but how does this impact Jerry Reese and Ben McAdoo in terms of their futures with the Giants? Do you look at what happened with Beckham and fault them, and look at what's happened with them in the 0-5 start and fault the Giants and fault their coaching staff and their personnel staff for getting them to this point?
Boy, a lot to unpack there, I don't fault them for Odell Beckham getting hurt, certainly. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, people get hurt. And it's terrible that Odell Beckham's hurt. I mean, it's terrible that J.J. Watt's hurt. Like, I don't root for teams, but I like watching football. And, sure. And I mean, I'm very sorry that Odell Beckham won't be playing the rest of the year. I really enjoy watching him play. So that's a that's a shame all the way around. In terms of the Giants' start, yeah, I mean, I fault Jerry Reese a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is... You wrote about this earlier. Look, this is a pet issue of mine. I covered that team for 3 years, mm-hmm. 2013 to 15, and saw the residue of the abysmal drafting that this man did for a period of 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And just a hollowed-out roster that had nothing, because miss after miss after miss in the second, third, fourth, fifth rounds, nothing. So last year, late in the year, I'm doing TV with folks that were saying, well, Jerry Reese has to be considered for executive of the year based on this year. And I said, you know what? Like, if you had a guy that started a fire, like, through negligence, and then just watched it burn for, like, 3 years while, like, people's careers ended because of it and all that stuff, and then he put that fire out, mm-hmm. you say, good job? Like, that last year was a blip in Jerry Reese's history as Giants GM, which is now, by the way, in its 11th season. Mm-hmm. And for those 11 years, has 4 playoff appearances to show. Now, everybody's going to say, well, they won the Super Bowl twice. Yes, they did. But that does not mean he's shown an ability to build through the draft, maintain a deep contender-type roster. I think we're at the point where we look over not just what's happened this year, but what's happened over 11 years with Jerry Reese and say, this man's not that good at the job, and it's really time for the Giants to have a different voice and a different vision leading their front office. I don't know if they'll do that, mm-hmm. but I think common sense indicates that they should.
What would you set the odds on them actually making a change of general manager if they finish, you know, 3-13 and are just 13. Not competitive?
3-13, I'd probably put the odds about 50-50 or a little better. And the reason they're that low is because it's the Giants. They have had 3 different GMs in the last 39 years.
It's a good job.
They don't. It's a good job. I mean, honestly, you don't have to. You don't have to succeed. Mm-hmm. You don't have to answer questions about your lack of success. Jerry Reese talks to the media 6 times a year, and 3 of them are on the weekend of the draft. Mm-hmm. It's a good job. You know, you can re-sign, like last year, Josh Brown, and then have him erupt in controversy and get kicked off the team, and mm-hmm. you don't even answer questions about it. You let your head coach and players do it. It's nice. It's nice work if you can get it. So I'm sure people would like to have it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, they really like Jerry Reese in there, and they don't like making changes. The 3 GMs in 39 years, that's an organizational philosophy. They believe in the importance of continuity at the leadership positions. They look at the Steelers, you know, who've done the same thing with GMs and coaches. And they look at, you know, who's won more Super Bowls than the Steelers? Nobody. So that's a belief of theirs, and they have stuck with it, and that's what's kept Jerry Reese in his position in spite of a poor track record. But 3-13? That's pretty awful. I mean, even those years I was covering, they managed to get back to 7-9, 6-10, 6-10, in spite of lousy starts. So 3-13, I think, would maybe be the kind of thing that justifies a change that they basically, at bottom, don't want to have to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're projected to finish 5-11 by the Football Power Index, which I know it's an all-encompassing algorithm, but it does not have especially good knowledge of injuries. It doesn't realize that the Giants are down their best, probably their best player at any position, I think it's fair to say, at this point, for the rest of the season. So not out of the question they finish that bad over the rest of the year. It does remind me a lot of the Jets over the past couple of years, and that the Jets, you know, for whatever John Idzik did poorly drafting, he did clear out cap space. They did have a lot of cap room to work with, and then Mike Maccagnan came in, spent a ton of money on a team, especially on the defensive side of the ball, built a defense that was impressive for 1 year. The Jets were a competitive team, and then the bottom fell out. And last year they were a mess, and they decided, okay, well, we had a false sense of hope, and we have to rebuild now, and cut a lot of those veterans, moved on. Obviously, they're off to a very impressive start, given how poor their roster looked heading into the year at 3-2. But do you think that the Giants embark on that sort of rebuild, whether it's Reese or somebody else, in terms of turning over their roster?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, look, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison because of the issue of the continuity. I mean, the Jets are changing GMs over and over again, and therefore changing visions and philosophies. So my question is, what is the vision or philosophy of the person that comes in? Do they stay in the family, quote unquote? You know, mm-hmm. do they keep it to a Giants person, meaning they would maybe promote from within, which I doubt after 3-13, if that's what we're postulating. Or do they go back and get like a Dave Gettleman who was there right mm-hmm. before he went to Carolina, someone they know will operate the way they kind of always operate. But I mean, to me, like you can argue, well, Idzik and Maccagnan, and there were circumstances and everything, but Jerry Reese is the constant here. And the way they operate the draft, never trading down, leaning on the scouts evaluation too much. I mean, I think you have to figure out if they make the move. And these are big ifs. I don't know if they're going to make a move at GM. Mm-hmm. Again, they're sort of intractable on this. But if they do, who do they bring in and why, and what is his mandate, right? What is the idea? What are you supposed? Are you supposed to change the way the Giants do business? Or are you supposed to continue the way the Giants do business and just do it better than Reese was doing the last, whatever, 6 or 7 years? So that's the question. And I think big decision to make on quarterback. Mm-hmm. They can get out of the Eli contract after this year if they want. It makes more sense financially to do it after next year. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, geez, if you're 3-13 and you're picking in the top 3 or 4 of this coming draft, you might have the opportunity to get a quarterback that you think is the legitimate long-term successor to Eli Manning and that you're mm-hmm. excited about. And if that's the case, then that might direct all your decisions. Right, like if you say, okay, hypothetically, just if Darnold or Josh Rosen or Josh Allen, if one of those guys is the guy they love and think is going to be the next Eli Manning and be their quarterback for 12 years, mm-hmm. then and you can get him, then maybe that makes you hurry the decision on Manning. Maybe that makes you more likely to move on. Maybe that makes you more likely to tear down and unload some of those big contracts that you signed last year. So to me, I think we're a long way from figuring out what the Giants do because, A, they don't really like to change anything in the first place, and mm-hmm. and we don't know if the final record will be one that compels them to do it, and if it is, then we have to know the specifics of their circumstances. So I think there's still a wide range of outcomes, but I think total rebuild is on the table considering how high the hopes were for this year and how far short of them they will obviously fall.
Mm-hmm. So Daniel Jeremiah of NFL Network yesterday postulated a fascinating trade rumor, not a rumor, but a trade idea on Twitter that I want to get your thoughts on. Would the Giants ever in a million years consider?
It takes them to do things. Yeah.
Yes. It would take a while, but would the Giants ever in a million years consider trading Eli Manning to the Jacksonville Jaguars this season? If the Jaguars called them tomorrow and said, yeah, that's, I mean, I had that reaction too, but it also kind of makes sense if you think you're going to go after a quarterback in this year's draft.
It makes sense if you strip out of the equation personal rancor, but you can't because the man running the Jacksonville Jaguars is Tom Coughlin,
yes,
who was fired 2 years ago and didn't think he should have been and has no relationship with Jerry Reese. And certainly I'm confident did not like the way Jerry Reese acted as Coughlin was on his way out the door saying, mm-hmm. I'm ultimately responsible, yet we had some close games we could have won this year. That's not really the way to go when you're in that situation. So I don't know. I think it would be very surprising for John Mara and Jerry Reese to trade Eli Manning to Tom Coughlin during this season. I guess stranger things have happened, but I wouldn't think it would take long to put together a list of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense for the Jags. I don't know that it necessarily makes sense for the Giants, given the possibility of them rebuilding and moving on from Eli after this season. But let's move on. Let's talk about the game you went to this weekend, I believe, which was Carolina-Detroit.
Correct.
What were your biggest takeaways from that Panthers-Lions game?
Cam Newton, who takes too much grief in general but deserved all the grief he took last week. Mm-hmm. Those are not two mutually exclusive sentiments. Is really good at football, and I don't know. I saw him play a game against the Giants 2 years ago where he threw five touchdown passes and ran for one. Mm-hmm. That was the game where Josh Norman and Odell Beckham went nuts and were at each other's throats the whole time. I think Cam might have played better on Sunday than he played that day. Like, it was incredible how in command of the offense he was. And watching their offense was really interesting to me because McCaffrey, we know, doesn't have big numbers yet. Mm-hmm. But you can see the way he impacts things that they do and the way the defense reacts to them because they can put him anywhere and the defense knows that there's something potentially coming there and they have to pay attention to him. So you now have a way to structure your offense so it's very, it has a lot of variety. So you can – there was one formation where at the goal line where they put the two big guys on the left, Funchess and Benjamin on the left, and then McCaffrey was the only one on the right. So it looked unbalanced, you know, because of the side, the relative size of these guys.
Right, of course.
And then, you know, they can go power run with Stewart. They didn't really use Newton on the ground. They had a couple design runs that didn't go anywhere. So I think they're an offense that has the ability to be a number of different things and change from week to week and even series to series. The one concern they have is the line. They've managed to get by okay without Ryan Khalil, the center, but Matt Khalil's been an issue, and now he's been banged up, so you worry about that a little bit. But I think they're a very good team with a very good defense that has reason to believe it can be a Super Bowl contender again after 1 year away from the playoffs. So I was impressed with what I saw from them. And overall, they went into Foxborough and beat a 2-1 Patriots team. They went into Detroit and beat a 3-1 Lions team. If they beat the 4-1 Eagles on Thursday night, you know, now you got to take notice of that stretch and say maybe this is a contender for one of the better teams in the league. Lions, for me, I think they're good on defense. I think the offense is fine, but I don't know why it takes them till the third or fourth quarter to get going. This was a problem for them last year too.
Yeah,
what is it about the design or execution of the Jim Bob Cooter offense that you know makes it so much better late in the game than it is at the beginning? I wonder if his great stuff is specifically tied to 2-minute style stuff, which you don't want to run the whole game for fear of exhausting your players. But I think they're a little bit limited on offense, and I would like to see, I guess, a little more creativity and explosiveness before I put them in the top echelon of NFC contenders.
Let's go back to the Lions, and then we'll go back to the Panthers before we get the break. But in terms of the Lions, I wonder if it's just the fact that I would assume they're passing more, you know, late in games. They're not committing to the run, which has been, especially last year, wasn't very good. This year it's been a little better with Amir Abdullah back, but, you know, their running game is not necessarily always a strong suit. So if they don't run the ball that much, you figure, you know, that might make get Matthew Stafford in rhythm. It might get the passing game might work a little better if they're kind of committing to it as opposed to committing to trying to be a balanced offense.
Yeah, and I mean, having Abdullah where they didn't last year, that enables them to try more with the run game. They're having more success with it, as you mentioned. But a couple of their players told me last week and on Sunday that, you know, defense has done a good job of what Caldwell tells them is making them play left-handed. So, like, and I'm talking to the Panthers before that game, Thomas Davis, he was saying, look, we know they throw a lot to their running backs, and we want to make sure and take that away. And so, you know, Theo Riddick was a big part of the offense the last couple of years, but now teams are focused on him. So now do you want to try and run the ball, and are you built to do that? And if not, how do you adjust around it? So I think the offense has kind of been in a situation where opponents have been able to dictate to them how they're going to play, and no one's comfortable like that, and maybe they just haven't made the overall adjustments to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a few different ways to think about it. That makes sense to me. I'm skeptical of the Lions' defense, I have to admit. I don't think when they're not forcing turnovers that they're going to be very good. And we saw what happened, you know, earlier this year. They looked great, but they were forcing three turnovers a game, four turnovers a game. On Sunday, they weren't able to force any turnovers. And they did an okay job against the Panthers, but Carolina moved the ball very effectively in that game. Ended up with how many yards did they have in that game? 362 yards in that game, a bunch of big plays. Cam was 26 of 33 for 355 and three touchdowns. They did stop the run. The running game for Carolina was actually not that good at all. They had 21 carries, I believe, for 28 yards, and that really actually ended up, in a way, almost costing them the game just because 28 carries, 28 yards, excuse me, that's even worse. And they couldn't run the ball in the fourth quarter to kind of run some clock, and that's how Detroit was able to get back in the football game late until Cam threw for that first down to kind of seal it. But their pass defense is going to be a problem when they're not forcing turnovers.
Yeah, they got to get pressure up front, right? I mean, they have to maintain the surprising pass rush. But that's what I'm saying about Cam the other day. Like, they couldn't run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Kelvin Benjamin touchdown, that was well covered. I mean, that throw was perfect.
Yeah.
Like, he was on to an extent. What we know about Cam Newton, what is he not good at? He's not accurate. But he was on Sunday to an extent that I think was really surprising. So I think you mentioned a couple big plays. Half the yards were, I think, to Ed Dixon on two plays. But Cam made some tougher throws, I think, than we were used to seeing him make, and I think that might have been the difference in a strong defensive performance versus what looks like a poor one for Detroit.
Yeah, 87.5 QBR for Cam in this game, 87.3 last week after that really disastrous game against the Saints. So it seems like he's kind of recovering from the surgery. He's getting in stride. He feels more comfortable throwing the football. And like you said, the McCaffrey thing is so fascinating because the numbers aren't there yet. No. But you did see, you saw in the Patriots game, there were plays where the Patriots were so keyed on McCaffrey that it freed up, you know, easy throws elsewhere. The Fozzie Whitaker screen pass, I believe, was one of those plays. And you have to figure, I don't know, maybe Ed Dixon suddenly turned into Randy Moss overnight.
Dude.
But you figure the only way Ed Dixon is getting wide open for 160 yards worth of catches is that the Lions are blowing assignments and they are perhaps distracted by someone else in the field and leaving the, I don't want to say plotting because that's mean, but no, he's methodical Ed Dixon
open, I mean,
for big plays.
Because, I mean, I said to him, after game, you got to finish one of those off, right? I mean, look, I mean, it's so bizarre. Cause I went in there last Friday and he was one of the players I talked to for my prep work for the game. And he's like, he's talking about how much he loves to help the tackles and pass block, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm never going to be a guy catching 60 balls. I saw him on the field after the game Sunday, and he lit up. He's like, hey, man, are you coming back this week? Like, I want to talk to you every week. So, I mean, it was out of nowhere. But the two big plays, right? I think there were 57 and 64 yards, the two long pass plays. The second one was a real good sell on the run fake. The entire Lions defense went into the middle because it looked like that there was a handoff, or I forget, maybe Cam was keeping it. But there was a fake, and all of a sudden Cam rolls out left, and there's Dixon and no one else on the field. So, I mean, well-designed plays both, and they got him open. But, Ed Dixon, I don't think the Eagles are going to get that tape and go, whoa, 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 we got to account for Dixon now. Like, I think that's something that overall, I think if people had stayed to their assignments, it might have been different. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, good on Carolina for finding those spots and taking advantage of them. I really think overall they played an excellent offensive game, especially when you consider – they weren't able to run the ball. I think part of playing an excellent offensive game is adjusting quickly to on the fly to what you can do and taking advantage of it, and I think that was an example of that.
Yeah, for sure. We're going to get to more Panther stuff, actually, after the break, but we're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. But first, guys, I've got some interesting facts for you here from the folks at Gillette. Did you know the tip of a Gillette razor blade is measured on an atomic scale? It means their blade edges are thinner than a single brain cell. And that precision, well, it's the work of many brain cells. The hundreds of members of Gillette's research and development team have spent over 4,700 years combined, working to make your shave closer and more comfortable. That's longer than the Egyptian pyramids have been around. And while over 1,000 craftsmen and women in Boston are busy making your blades, another team is putting your blades through more than 60 extremely strict and precise quality checks. Fail just one of these tests, and it does not leave the factory. In other words, the hardworking people at Gillette never stop working to make your blades better. And now, that includes the price tag, because you can get Gillette blades at their lowest prices in years. See for yourself at GilletteOnDemand.com. Gillette, the best a man can get. Pricing applies to select products and is at the sole discretion of the retailer. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined again by Dan Graziano, also of ESPN, to talk about Week 5 of the NFL season a little bit. We have some stuff we're going to get to in a moment. But first, let's talk about the Carolina Panthers, who we just got to before the break. Let me ask you, Dan. Now, the Chiefs are pretty much, I think everyone would say they're the best team in football. They have the best record. They're the last undefeated team. They look phenomenal. They have a lot of victories over talented football teams. Certainly, I think anyone would say the Chiefs are the best team in football right now.
Yeah, based on performance to date, absolutely.
Sure. Who's number two?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think both teams that are in this week's Thursday night game are in the discussion. I mean, 4-1 Eagles, who I think are playing, you know, better than I might have expected them to, and the Panthers, who were a perennial playoff team before bottoming out last year, and you know, have a lot of the same guys. So, and they've played two very, very good games in a row against road games in New England and Detroit against good teams. You look at Atlanta at 3-1, but they've wobbled a couple times, right? Yeah. New England, we assume, will ultimately be one of the best teams, but so far they haven't looked like themselves, especially on defense. So, you know, Seattle's got some things to sort out. Pittsburgh's got some things to sort out. So, yeah, I mean, Oakland and Kansas City's division doesn't look like it's there yet. So, I mean, I'm looking at the NFC and I'm thinking Philly, thinking Atlanta, I'm thinking Carolina, and yeah, I mean, those are interesting teams that really weren't necessarily Atlanta, obviously, but a couple of them weren't necessarily in last year's picture, and now they are sitting there and threatening for that kind of role. So, I mean, where are the I guess one the best way to analyze is where are the weaknesses and where do they fall apart? And we could go to the Chiefs and say, you know, is the defense going to hold up all year? But with Carolina, I think the offensive line is what to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, if they can get consistent performance from the offensive line, and of course the quarterback, who's been inconsistent so far this year, then they probably can maintain.
Yeah, I think health is going to be the big thing for Carolina too, in that, you know, you saw last year, they didn't have Luke Kuechly for a chunk of the season with that concussion, and that really hurt their defense pretty dramatically. Cam got hurt and wasn't his usual self for most of the year. Jonathan Stewart's someone who gets hurt very frequently. And already they're down Greg Olsen, who obviously is going to be a big part of that team when healthy. So they have a lot of guys who are incredibly talented, but even thinking of Thomas Davis as well, you know, guys who are either have a history of injuries, who are perhaps at a point in their career where they're, you know, going to be a little more brittle, Julius Peppers being someone who might come into play there. So it's going to be tough, but those guys are going to have to stay healthy and productive, because they're a deeper team than they've been in years past, but there's still so many players in that team who just, they're not replaceable.
Yeah.
And I mean, roster.
You know, they I know from talking to them in camp and so far this year, I mean, they really feel like they have more depth on the offensive line than they did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really happy with the way they've weathered the Ryan Khalil injury at center. So, you know, they also, you know, one of their big weaknesses when you go back a year ago were those two cornerbacks that were playing as rookies and were getting roasted. And those two guys have played better, although one of them, Worley, left the game with an injury the other day. So you obviously that gets to your point about health. But yeah, when they're at full strength, they seem to have they have top caliber players at a lot of different positions.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Falcons, and I have to admit, I'm still pretty skeptical on the Falcons. Not because, you know, you watch that Packers game, they outplayed the Packers. That was a great win, and I think that's certainly a credit to them. But you think about the rest of their schedule so far this year, they could really easily be 1-3. They came down to one play against the Bears and the Lions, where honestly they got lucky. The Bears dropped a pass in the end zone that would have given them a victory week one. The Lions, you know, they came a quarter of a yard short of the end zone with 11 seconds left that would have given them a victory there. And they lost to the Bills, and the Bills outplayed them in that game. They had injuries. Julio Jones went down, of course. Mohamed Sanu went out, so that didn't help things. But realistically, I mean, we wouldn't be sitting here and saying, oh, the Falcons are incredibly lucky to be 1-3. We'd be saying, hey, they blew those two leads late in games. And so I'm a little skeptical of Atlanta right now. I do think the Eagles are playing genuinely really good football. I think seeing their running game kind of develop over the past couple of weeks has been very promising. And you think about their schedule, they lost to the Chiefs. I mean, you know, if you're going to lose to anyone, you might as well lose to the best team in football so far. So I certainly think that given, you know, the range of teams they've played, I can't fault the Eagles for losing there. And I think that they have a lot of impressive victories on the other side of the football as well.
They have impressive victories, and I wrote about this last week. The NFC East schedules are a big story for me. Everybody's got to go west. Everybody's leaving the time zone over and over again. The Eagles have already put to bed a couple of their tougher ones. You know, I mean, like, the Giants aren't a factor anymore, but they, you know, they still have to go to Denver. And, you know, like, I think Washington has to go back to L.A. Dallas is out of the time zone all the time. They've already been through a Denver-Arizona stretch that they got through 1-1. But I think the Eagles' travel schedule is pretty good for the next month and a half. And then there's a stretch late in the season where they have Seattle and L.A. back-to-back, but they'll probably stay out there. So, you know, they've weathered an early part of the season that could have been very challenging for them, and they come out of it 4-1. Now, a tough road game on a short week, probably without Lane Johnson this Thursday. Certainly if they can win that, if they can go down to Carolina on Thursday and win that, then you know, now you've really put some really impressive stuff in the bank. And you mentioned the one loss, obviously, to a team that hasn't lost to anyone. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I just wonder. I mean, I look at them and I think they're young, especially the quarterback, as impressive as he is. And I wonder if they're kind of a year away. But you're right. I mean, the run game seems to have come together better than we might have expected at this point. And it can sort of be a chameleon week to week, right? Lean harder on LeGarrette Blount one week than you know. And they've shown some depth. They've lost Sproles. They've lost Smallwood, and they continue to run the ball. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there's always teams that are better than we expect. I didn't expect the Eagles to be a contender right away this year, but they are, and you know, we'll see if they stay there.
Yeah, they could be this year's Raiders, you know, a team that where they do kind of arrive a little quicker than we were expecting. Wouldn't it be crazy? And there was a dramatic drop-off for Carson Wentz. There was last year, certainly, with Lane Johnson out of line. I think it was about a 24-point difference in QBR. So we're going to have to see if he can, you know, be the same quarterback without his right tackle in Carolina on Thursday. I'd also throw the Packers out there. You know, again, a 4-1 team, but their loss to the Falcons, you'd figure, okay, it's not the worst loss, all things considered. And then otherwise, so far this year, beat the Seahawks, who they're not great so far, but they're the Seahawks. They're still a pretty tough team. Blew out the Bears, did narrowly beat the Bengals. That was not that impressive at home. But then they went to Dallas on Sunday and beat the Cowboys in a game where, honestly, it shouldn't have been that close, given that they missed two extra points and had a two-point conversion where Aaron Rodgers missed an open receiver. I thought it was a really impressive performance on the road against a very good Cowboys team. So I wouldn't fault anyone for thinking they were the second-best team in football.
No, I agree with you. What amazes me. I mean, like Aaron Rodgers, I heard he was going back to Hogwarts for a reunion during their bye this week. Like, I don't understand what he does. Like, they are missing their tackles. They're missing their running back. They've played a game without Jordy Nelson, a game without Randall Cobb. There he is at the end doing magical things.
Yeah.
I think there's a case to be made, maybe a discussion for another day, that Aaron Rodgers, like, it currently for the last couple of years, is maybe playing the quarterback position as well as anyone ever has.
Yeah.
In terms of the way he's operating the offense, the physically, the throws he's making, you know, the guy makes Hail Marys look routine. So I think that's, yes, if they've been able to get through this part of their season with a 4-1 record, with the injuries they've had, with the schedule they've played, and then they get healthier and things ease out, then obviously they're a terrifying team because, you know, I go back to the NFC Championship game in Atlanta. The Falcons were up, I believe, 24-25-0 at the half.
Yeah.
Up by 25 points. And I talked to somebody with the Falcons, like, in line for food at halftime. I said, how you feeling? He said, not feeling great. You know, number 12's not human. I said, it's 25. He's not human. Trust me, he's not human. So they didn't feel good until they were definitely sure that day. And that's what he does to you. I mean, the Cowboys, they must see him in their nightmares at this point.
You figure. I mean, it's a thing where, you know, I wouldn't necessarily pick him for MVP every year because there's just, you know, different levels of production, you have injuries. He wasn't, you know, there was a stretch where he wasn't playing that well early last season. But in terms of the actual best player in football, I think I'm taking Aaron Rodgers most of the time, just in terms of if it's one quarterback to save my life, you know, he's the guy. Right? He's the guy I'm picking
with a minute and 30 to go. I mean, they get the ball back with a minute and a half to go, and you're thinking the Cowboys are in trouble.
Yeah,
like, how else makes you think? Brady, I think, and maybe Breeze, but I mean, very few make you think that. They left him too much time, and he's one of those guys, and it's incredible the way, you know, I talk about how I'll miss seeing Beckham. I mean, it's just guys that you. Whoever you root for, whoever you don't root for, I mean, there you see them on the TV, you cannot turn it off.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw one other team out there that's not, maybe not going to hold up, and you'll laugh when I say them, but...
It's Jets?
No.
Oh,
the team with the best point differential in all of football through five games. Do you know who that is?
Well, I do because I read your notes before the show. But, so
the Jacksonville Jags.
People will look behind the curtain there that we shouldn't. Yeah.
3-2, but their wins by 22 points over the Texans, granted with Tom Savage, but still 22 points, beat the Ravens by 37 points, and then beat the Steelers on Sunday by 21 points. Do you think, even if you think they're not going to be the second best team in football going forward,
which I don't,
fair, no one is going to take you to task for that. Do you think they are at least have a part in the discussion for being, if not the second best team, at least a top five team in football through 5 weeks so far?
I mean, when was the last time they had a 500 season? It was 2010. Like, I think to put them top five would be, I think that's a stretch. But I'll give them this: they're a legitimate playoff contender, and here's why: they play in the AFC South. They have a very good defense. Their next several games are home against the Rams, at the Colts, home against the Bengals, home against the Chargers, at the Browns, at the Cardinals, home against the Colts. They don't play the world's toughest schedule. Mm-hmm. And they've shown an ability to beat, you know, the teams in the AFC North that I think is supposed to be better than they are. So, yeah, I mean, my issue with the Jaguars is this. They are asking their quarterback to do nothing. And I mean, like, nothing. It is give the ball to Fournette. We will win with defense. And if you have to throw it, it means something has gone wrong. Plans A, B, C, and D didn't work. So there's going to come a point in the season where Blake Bortles is going to have to do something to win them a game. And it does not appear from the outside as if the Jacksonville Jaguars believe he can or trust him to do it. And I think that ultimately ends up being a problem. Because, I mean, look, talk about the way internal dynamics work with a team. And people look to the quarterback as the leader. You know, the quarterback gets a lot of attention. That can stir resentment in some cases. It can make eyes roll. So I think at some point the focus goes back on him no matter how much they try to keep it off of him. And I'm not sure what he'll do once that happens.
Yeah, and you did kind of see that to some extent in week two against Tennessee where they weren't able to run the ball especially effectively. And they had to rely on Bortles, and he was predictably Bortles-esque. He was 20 of 34 for 223 with a touchdown and two picks and a fumble. And most of that came in the fourth quarter when they were down multiple scores. He was Blake Bortles. He was everything you expected. So, you know, certainly I'm not sitting here saying that I think Blake Bortles is any better than he's been in years past. If anything, I think he has less confidence, so he might be worse. But they do at least have a legit defense, and they have shown the ability to, you know, play the kind of game that they have been hoping to play for a couple of years now, which is, you know, to be able to hold up on defense, run the football effectively. Obviously, the addition of Leonard Fournette has changed that offense. He's been the best running back they've added in their four-year stretch of trying to find a starting running back. And the defense is legitimately good. And I think if you had questions about, you know, their strength of competition, given that they play the Texans, Titans, Ravens, and Jets for the first 4 weeks of the year, I think they put that to rest on Sunday, given that they played really impressive football against the Steelers, who we should finish up with them, because I don't know how you feel about them, but certainly it seems like that is a team that doesn't appear to have the answers for themselves about what's going wrong right now.
They don't. And I think there's too many answers swirling around that building. There's a very strange dynamic going on there. And I think it's born of the fact of just way too many talented players. And I mean, you don't want to say that. Because everybody would love to have too many talented players. But the fact is, you have Antonio Brown, you got 19 targets the other day in a loss. It's going to make other people upset.
Sure.
I know for a fact from talking to sources there that Martavis Bryant went to the coaches last week and asked them if he could be more of a focal point of the offense, and especially in the red zone and on deeper passes. And I think, you know, the message from Martavis was, hey, the offense isn't clicking. I feel like I can do more than you're asking me to do. So they come out against the Jaguars, and Antonio Brown throwing a fit on the field in Baltimore the week before. They come out against the Jaguars, who have a poor run defense.
Right.
And they just start chucking it all over the yard, and I think it's probably because the wide receivers were complaining. So, like, they're trying to keep them happy, and as a result, they put together a game plan that doesn't fit the opponent, and they get destroyed. They throw five interceptions. And now Le'Veon Bell is complaining they didn't run enough after they ran 35 times a week before. And so round and round it goes. So they got to get a handle on this, because they have to establish something consistent and some kind of identity on offense that isn't just, hey, we have all these great players, because it's really not working right now. And this is why I get back to what I said about Bortles. I mean, the quarterback is the center of it all. And if Ben Roethlisberger is publicly saying things like, maybe I don't have it anymore, that's not exactly a cry for the team to rally around, right? Like, you know.
No.
So I think there's some issues going on there that are off the field and in the planning and execution part of it that aren't just, you know, some of the issues other teams have, like health and that kind of thing. And they got to get it together, because they should win that division, given the Ravens' limitations on offense, given the Bengals' offensive line issues and tendency to implode, and the Browns' continued refusal to be a part of the rest of the league. So they should win that division going away, but, you know, 3-2 and just coming off one of their worst losses really, I think, probably ever in Roethlisberger's tenure, they have some questions to answer.
Do you were you surprised to hear Roethlisberger say that?
I mean, I don't know the man well. I mean, like, he's not, you know, but yes. I mean, week five, you have a quarterback who was publicly contemplating retirement in the offseason, who's only 33, which is certainly not old for a quarterback in this day and age. And he's 33. Did I have that wrong? Anyway, he's not 40. He's mid-30s. So, yeah, I don't, I don't, I don't know what that means. I don't know whether that's you know, sometimes in the wake of a tough loss, people just kind of are down and say things, and then the next day, like, did I really say that? Or is that something that's really in his head right now? And if it is, then that could be really more alarming than anything else we've talked about the Steelers. Because if the quarterback is lacking confidence, it's one thing if you're Blake Bortles and you lack confidence. It's another thing if you're Ben Roethlisberger with two Super Bowl rings and lacking confidence. That is something that the Steelers obviously would not expect to have to deal with.
Yeah, certainly not. And we talked about the Chiefs as the best team in football. And while you look at the schedule this week, and guess who the Steelers are playing? They're at Kansas City this week. So they're at the best team in football. If they lose this game, they're down to 3-3. And you have major question marks about the offense. I mean, is this something where you think they're just going to kind of have to wait it out and just hope that on the other side of this rut, they're going to be an effective team again? Or do you think they would feasibly consider making some kind of change in midseason?
Like, what kind of change?
Well, you'd figure, do they consider moving on from Todd Haley?
Yeah.
Do they change the offense to some extent?
How drastic? Yeah, I think some kind of change to the offense and what they're trying to do. I mean, you hear expressions thrown around a lot, like, oh, they went back to basics. They simplified the offense after a team meeting in week six, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we could end up hearing that story about the Steelers if they go on an 8-game winning streak. I mean, that's not, you know, that's a pattern we've seen. I don't get the sense that they would move on from Haley mid-season. I think that certainly, I mean, they're 3-2. You know, they're not 0-5.
Right.
You know, so I think it's more about trying to figure out what can be done internally to sort of feed all these mouths and keep everybody happy. Obviously, I think winning helps. But, you know, they won pretty decisively in Baltimore 2 weeks ago and seem to have come out of it with people still annoyed at each other. So I don't know. Something's got to be done about the dynamic in that locker room. And I think, you know, if the offense were going the way that everybody told them it was supposed to, it might feel different. But it's not, and they're looking for answers.
Do you think they beat the Chiefs on Sunday?
See, now you get me with these predictions. I know I made the predictions. I sent the predictions in. I believe... I picked the Steelers.
Already?
Yeah, because, well, you know, they're due early in the week, you know. I picked the Steelers, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm not doing well in the predictions, and I need to make up ground. And
sure.
I assume a lot of people will pick the Chiefs.
Fair.
So I feel like this is an opportunity, maybe. But, I mean, one of these weeks, the Steelers, and I know they're not the same on the road, they're probably going to lose. I probably will not get that game right. But if I do, I'll be back next week on shows crowing about it. I think one of these weeks they're going to be awesome, like unstoppably awesome.
Yeah.
And I think given how much discussion there is going on right now about what's wrong and what to do about it, and given that the sense I get is not that people are sniping but that people are kind of desperately looking for answers, I think this could be the kind of week where Pittsburgh kind of hits some degree of rock bottom and figure something out. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not going to be surprised 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks from now if somebody says, oh, you know what, it was a meeting back in week six, where so-and-so said this, and the coaches said this, and all of a sudden everything clicked. And I have a hunch. I mean, Kansas City's not going 16-0, and just sort of the way that the things regress to the mean, a loss to Pittsburgh at home feels like the kind of thing we'd be talking about in December, like we're talking about tiebreakers and stuff. So
I agree.
It's sort of the way the universe is kind of constructing itself around the 2017.
I also think of things that way.
Yeah.
So I echo that. I know I'm not supposed to. I know I should be
more rational. We like to trust in data.
Yes, but I also think, like, I could see myself writing this column at the end of the year.
Right?
That makes total sense to me. So, yeah. And, I mean, it wouldn't be that crazy to imagine the Steelers winning. Of course, the offense, even with that one bad game, the majority evidence we have is that this is a pretty good offense. And even if they're struggling, they should still be reasonably effective. And something that's been kind of overshadowed by the offensive struggles has been that the defense has been great. I mean, this is a really impressive Steelers defense. Ryan Shazier is playing like a defensive player of the year candidate. And even though they weren't necessarily all that great against the Jags last week, a lot of that was defensive touchdowns.
Yeah, I mean, short fields. Yep.
Yeah, so I wouldn't fault the defense for how they played against the Jags on Sunday. Of course, they had that long 90-yard touchdown run when the game was basically, no longer a contest at 23-9. So, you know, that counts, but I don't think it counts quite as much. And I think overall, even though they've played a pretty easy slate of quarterbacks, they've been pretty impressive so far. So I do think that you could maybe see a game where the Steelers' defense is what actually holds up for them, and and gives the offense a chance to win, as opposed to years past when it's really been the other way around.
Steelers outgained the Jaguars 371 yards to 313 in a 21-point loss.
Mm-hmm.
So you're obviously correct there. And I just, you know, I just feel like, you know, it's a team that is going to be better than it has been so far, and that's going to happen at some point. So the NFL analysis, people forget. Almost all of these teams are almost exactly as good as each other.
Mm-hmm.
The margin between, I mean, you talk about like the middle 24 teams in the league, they're pretty tightly bunched, and
yeah.
There aren't too many major upsets. You don't get a lot of Iowa State, Oklahoma stuff in the NFL.
Don't, but this week, it's the Browns have to win sometime.
Is there a rule about that? Because I don't see, is that in the game operations manual?
That's in the news. Yeah, it's right up there with other things that are in the game operations manual that we were not aware of either. I mean, the Browns, they do play the Chargers. That worked last year.
That's who they got last year. The Browns, I mean, what? At some point they win a game, but, I mean, they do so many things to not win. I mean, that game against the Jets, I mean, how many opportunities did they have to actually even pull away? And, that's kind, the other end of the spectrum.
Kind of staggering. But I have faith the Browns. They outgained the Jets by 200 yards in that game, by the way, and lost. The Browns will win at some point. It might not be this week, but a lot of huge favorites this week. A lot of 11-point favorites. Cleveland at Houston. The Patriots are 9.5 favorites at the Jets. At the Jets. Mm-hmm. Atlanta's an 11-point favorite at home against Miami. Washington, 9.5-point favorites hosting San Francisco. The Broncos, 12-point favorites on Monday night against the Giants. So let me finish with this. Dan, if you had to pick one of those teams to win outright, the Browns, the Jets, the Dolphins, the Niners, and the Giants, who would you pick to win straight up on Sunday or Monday?
The Niners.
Really?
I picked them.
You picked them?
It's the Kyle Shanahan revenge game.
Oh, nice. I like it.
There's a lot of bad blood there with Dan Snyder. He's going to be motivated. The Niners have lost their last four games by a combined total of 11 points, including the last two in overtime on the road. They're not far away from winning a game. Now, I mean, they're far away from contending, but they're not far away from winning a game. I know Washington's at home coming off a bye. But again, though, this gets back to this sort of, and I'd like to talk to you more about this because I didn't realize there were other people that thought like I do. This gets back to sort of the way the football universe kind of sort of constantly folds in on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Washington loses games like this. Like, that's part of their thing. Like I can see the entire Washington fan base on Monday in the talk radio down there going, how do you lose a game like this? And then Kyle Shanahan and all this stuff. Like, that, it just feels like a game that team historically kind of loses just for the sake of being them. And I don't know how else to put it other than, again, you know, most of these teams are pretty close together. San Francisco is far away, but they have a win coming. They're closer than the Browns are, I think. And I'm telling you, man, Kyle Shanahan, he's going to pull out all the stops.
Mm-hmm. So you think it'd be like a three-touchdown Kyle Juszczyk game or something like that?
How many touchdowns do the Niners have totaled so far this year? Is it three?
It's not a ton.
I believe they've only scored touchdowns in two of their five games.
They have.
So they're not an offensive juggernaut. But
seven touchdowns.
You know, they got Juszczyk. They paid him a lot of money. I got to believe he's got more of a role going forward than he's had so far. And now with Carlos Hyde banged up, I think they have to reassess some things on offense. But Pierre Garçon is going back there. It's a Pierre Garçon revenge game, too.
That's double revenge.
I think Aldrick Robinson will give him the Aldrick Robinson revenge game.
Aldrick Robinson revenge game? There's a lot of revenge to be had.
Kyle's guys know they wanted to do it for Kyle, so I'm telling you, watch it. We'll talk about this later after it comes to pass.
We'll fill it in. Next week we'll have an emergency episode of the podcast celebrating the Niners
just
victory.
About that game.
Tremendous. Well, Dan, thank you so much. Where can people check out more of what you're working on?
ESPN.com. We'll have a story previewing Panthers-Eagles. Going up on Thursday. I wrote a column today on sort of a what we learned from the week where I kind of laid out in more detail my argument for getting rid of Jerry Reese. I'll be on Sunday NFL Countdown on Sunday from the Saints-Lions game in New Orleans. I'm kind of all over the place, man.
Tremendous. Well, Dan,
I'm trying.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
I appreciate
you back
having
on.
Me.
You'll be back on later on in the season, I have no doubt. But
thanks.
My pleasure. All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for listening to the show today. I'll be on the Nickel Package tomorrow, talking a couple of interesting topics on our Wednesday episode of the Daily Football Podcast with you at ESPN, and more Bill Barnwell Show coming, of course, later on this week. So thanks so much for listening, and more to come.